Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Tara Arkell, a writer, poet, broadcaster and producer, the daughter of legendary actress Dame Joan Collins and iconic British singer-songwriter Anthony Newley. Tara also has the late best-selling novelist Jackie Collins as her aunt. In the early 90s, Tara worked as a singer-songwriter, later moving into radio and TV presenting. Her debut novel, Radio Honey, was inspired by her real-life experience as a presenter at an all-female radio station. It was shortlisted at the Novel London Literary Festival. Also with us is Jeff Pridmore, the author of Teach Yourself Journalism, and has worked as a freelance feature writer, a copywriter, a literary agent's reader, and is also an actor and independent filmmaker. His debut novel, The Reunion, begins in 1963 when a former prisoner of war sets out to reconnect with his family. Also joining us tonight is Melissa Oliver, whose debut novel, The Rebel Heiress and the Knight, has recently been awarded the Romantic Novelists Association prestigious Joan Hessian Award. They praise the novel's very real characters and enjoyed how the history was beautifully woven into the story. It's a medieval romance set against a backdrop of real historical events. There's also a nod to the legend of Robin Hood. And finally, on tonight's book show is Lauren North, who writes psychological suspense novels that delve into the darker side of relationships and families. Her latest novel, One Step Behind, is about Jenna, a wife, a mother, a doctor, and also the victim of a stalker. That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Pens in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Tara Arkell. She's a writer, poet, broadcaster and producer, the daughter of legendary actress Dame Joan Collins and iconic British singer-songwriter Anthony Newley. Tara also has the late best-selling novelist Jackie Collins as her aunt. In the early 90s, Tara worked as a singer-songwriter, later moving into radio and TV presenting. Her poetry was longlisted for the National Poetry Competition last year, and her debut novel, Radio Honey, is now out. It's inspired by her real-life experience as a presenter at an all-female radio station. Welcome to the book show, Tara.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to chat with you. Thanks for joining us. And how do you feel about writing your first novel? What kind of an experience was it?
Well, it has been the most enjoyable, experience I could have imagined, because I've had such great reception for the novel. And I suppose when you write, you're in isolation, you're sort of hopefully pleasing yourself, having a few giggles if it's a comedy, which this in essence has hopefully quite a few funny moments. And indeed, my friends have been telling me that they've been choking on their coffee in the morning. It has been bringing tears to people's eyes in one way or another. But funnily enough, this was written many years ago, and I sort of couldn't find a publisher for it at the time. So I put it on a shelf and got on with writing a screenplay, which then went on to win some awards. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, I'm not such a crap writer after all. I'll go back to it. And I sent it to Faber and Faber's manuscript service because I thought, well, I'll get a proper review from somebody who knows. And they came back and said, look, this deserves to find an agent. And moreover, it feels strange that such a strong, ballsy female character as your protagonist should feel so fresh in the 21st century. And I think that's quite interesting as well. Obviously, since I first wrote this, we have had the Me Too movement. We've got some great female voices like Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And perhaps despite, you know, my Aunt Jackie Collins, we have moved forward in some way whereby women's voices are more readily acceptable, strong, strident female voices, which indeed my narrator is.
Yes, that's fantastic. I mean, it must have been strange in a very good way, obviously, having the likes of Jackie Collins as your auntie to then want to get into writing yourself. Did that add a certain amount of pressure, do you think?
You know, I think coming from such a big sort of glitzy background has meant that I've taken some detours in figuring out what it was I was good at. But behind everything I've done has been the love of the word. And I started off loving poetry and writing short stories and wanting to be a poet. And people said, oh, you can't be a poet. That's not a career. So I went off and became a journalist and put my words into pop lyrics as a singer-songwriter. So the word was always around, but it wasn't until later in life that I really sort of thought, you know what, this is really what I love doing. I need to actually hunker down and do this every day. And it got to a point in my life where, you know, my kids had grown up and I had more time to do that. So it's become much more available to me now to pursue my wildest dreams, if you like. I mean, as far as Auntie Jackie being a writer and my mum being a writer, it's obviously in the genes somewhere. And, I can almost feel Auntie Jackie leaning on my shoulder with a wry smile. But it's funny because I never really read her novels. But when I was sort of 13, 14, I did read some of the naughty bits for a bit of information, which I wasn't getting anywhere else. So God bless her.
Oh, I bet she would have been very proud of you.
I hope so.
Yes. So with regards to the subject matter then, I know you said you wrote it a while ago, but it was very much inspired by your real life experience working at an all-female radio station. Tell us about that time, can you?
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible time. And I'd spent many years working my way up through the radio ranks. I started out doing little radio inserts for Capital Radio with Neil Fox, and then sort of worked for LBC, talk radio. In fact, funnily enough, I used to do the New Voices series for them, or sometimes the Graveyard Shift overnight. But then the sort of culmination of those years in radio was – as a drive time DJ for the first all-female radio station. And it does indeed give me a wonderful background for this novel to explore the sort of estrogen-fueled environment of an all-female radio station. And as you know, the radio environment is pretty wild and crazy as it is, but stick a bunch of women sort of with all that estrogen going around into one area. And for me, it felt like a really fun, explosive drama to explore, which is what I did. And a lot of people are saying this also feels like a TV show, which, you know, hopefully I'm hoping it will be, because writing the characters, I got very carried away. I really enjoyed writing the story here and living in these characters' world. And so I had a lot of fun with it. And from the response I'm getting, people are enjoying reading it. So that's great.
Yeah. Interesting things can happen when you have a group of women together, can't you? It can go so many different ways.
I know. And, you know, I think sometimes it's a shame that women don't support each other a bit more. Sometimes I feel that we can be very competitive and our own worst enemies. And, you know, there's this sort of competitiveness that seems to happen when you have women together. And maybe that's why feminism has taken so long to really take root and be celebrated, even in the 21st century. You know, we still haven't managed to sort of arise into the 21st century and embrace all of the necessary elements, which I think that we need to fully come out and support each other. You know, domestic abuse is still on the rise. We still don't have parity in pay. Women are the first port of call in wars to be abused. And, with FGM, it's women mutilating other women. So I think it's a very interesting environment in which to explore what it means to be a woman in the 21st century. And if you read the novel, you'll find that my narrator does explore a lot of what it means to be a woman living today and asks a lot of questions. And her father is this sort of frustrated scientist, so she gets a lot of social commentary from him, which can be quite fun and which I've woven into the storyline.
And that's Cass you're talking about.
That's right, yeah. Yes.
So what can you tell us about her? What's she like?
Well, Cass is a young woman who is basically trying to come to terms with her life, with what it means to be, to try and find love. She hasn't found love and she doesn't understand how one achieves that. Is there this sort of magical formula for finding the perfect guy? And she's beginning to think that maybe this is never going to happen for her. And she's got, as I mentioned, her father, who's a sort of frustrated scientist come social commentator. And he sort of fills her head with all these statistics and studies and perhaps confuses the issue even more for her. So she needs to find her own way through life and needs to kind of find her own voice. And in a way, it's a coming of age novel, but I also feel that we're always coming of age. It doesn't matter what age you are. And I feel you can teach an old dog new tricks. I'm learning stuff every day. And I hope that we all are, you know, not entrenched thinking that we know it all. So I think a coming of age novel can happen to characters of any age. My character happens to be sort of late 20s, early 30s. And she's really trying to figure out what makes her tick in the framework of her larger world.
Yes. Oh, sounds great. And when you're writing it, when you're writing comedy, do you find yourself laughing at it yourself? And when you're picturing the different scenarios as you're right, you're laughing. And that's like a good benchmark for knowing that other people are going to find it funny.
Definitely. And one thing I think I've learned is that you have to please yourself first when you're writing. You can't worry about what other people think. I mean, I wrote this book and nobody wanted it, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And that's fine. You know, sometimes you need to mellow and change as a person. Sometimes it's your work that needs to wait for its time. And when I was writing this, there were times where I did laugh out loud. And and that's good. That's always good. Because because you're in a room alone. So, you know, at least, you know, you're having a good time, hopefully entertaining yourself. So certainly, like I said, I'm very fond of my characters and I'd love to revisit them at some point. I'm actually now working on a second novel, not revisiting those characters, but another hotbed of hopefully wild and funny women.
Oh, fantastic. So do you think you might come back to these characters then? There could be a sequel.
I think what I'd really like to do is write a TV series for these characters. Obviously, I have written screenplays before, and it's a format that I do enjoy because I love dialogue. I can see this becoming, something almost beyond the page. So I think for me, I would really love to write the sitcom because we've had Frasier, which is set in a radio station. There are some American sitcoms that have been set in radio stations, but obviously they were mostly male based. So I think it's time for us to explore the all female radio station on the page and off the page.
Oh, definitely. I'm all for it. Absolutely. So is there much difference? Is it a whole different ball game when you sit down to write a screenplay compared to writing a novel?
The basic premise is the same in terms of the story arc. So you know that by page 10 in a screenplay, pretty much like in a novel, you need to be introducing to your audience the sort of main overcoming obstacle for your narrator. So in essence, you need to be following a story arc. In a screenplay, obviously, there's less information about, wallpaper and where and setting, and you can sort of enjoy the dialogue a bit more. But, you know, sometimes a screenplay can be very visceral and very visual. And again, that can be quite fun to create that as a storyteller. So they are different, and formatting on the page is quite different. When you're writing a screenplay, there is a format that you follow. In essence, I think you're telling a story. So, and trying to get that across and pull the reader in as much as possible.
Yes, definitely. And going back to your showbiz upbringing, as you said earlier, when you were growing up, I'm sure for you they were just mummy and daddy, but do you remember a particular moment where you realised that your parents were famous?
I don't think, you know, when you're growing up and you're small, it all seems very much horses for courses. I think it's when you get a bit older that the penny drops. I think when I used to go and see my dad on big stages in Las Vegas and I'd be in the audience, that was definitely a point at which one grasps the fact that your parent is larger than life in terms of the work that they're doing. My mum was very much a working mother as when I was growing up at home. And she didn't really hit the big time with Dynasty until I'd gone off to university. So that all that madness was sort of taking place outside my immediate circle. Because, you know, up until that point, she was a gigging actress, just taking the work that she could and to put food on the table. So, you know, I did come from this sort of crazy creative background, but it's what we did, you know.
Yes, absolutely. I know that you, when you were working at this radio station that we talked about earlier, Graham Norton was doing news reviews there, and I love his show, massive fan of his, and he's done some fabulous interviews, or has interviewed your mum so many times on his shows, which had me in stitches. She's got so many great stories.
I love Graham Norton so much. I think he is probably our greatest entertainer. I just love him. And he did come on to my Christmas special when I was doing the all-female radio station Viva 963 AM. And I will remember him forever because even back then he was hilarious, absolutely a brilliant raconteur and comic genius. And he turned up on his bicycle and regaled us, all afternoon. So he, back then, he was brilliant and continues to be so.
Yes. Well, it's been a real pleasure to chat with you, Tara Arkell. Thank you so much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of your book, it's called Radio Honey, and it's available on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section there. Tara, thanks for being with us on Talk Radio Europe.
Thank you so much. An absolute pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Jeff Pridmore, who's the author of Teach Yourself Journalism. He was a winning finalist in BBC Radio 4's Fresh Air Media Competition. He's worked as a freelance feature writer, a copywriter, a literary agent's reader, and is also an actor and independent filmmaker. He recently completed a master's in history at the University of Exeter. He joins us on the book show now to talk about his debut novel. It's called The Reunion, and it begins in 1963 when a former prisoner of war sets out to reconnect with his family. Welcome to the book show, Jeff.
Hello, thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. So it seems like there's a lot to talk to you about other than being an author. You're doing lots of different things and have done lots of different things.
I was doing lots of different things, always in, the idea of really becoming a full-time professional writer and author. But, to begin with, the money doesn't come in and, you find yourself doing lots of other things and going down different avenues, trying to sort of establish a pathway, basically, into working as a professional writer or working as a professional actor. And it could almost become confusing at the end of the day, or it became confusing to me because I was thinking, wow, which direction do we take this in? I've always wanted to be a writer, always wanted to be an author. That's an ambition that goes back to childhood. But it's not an easy thing to really get into and really sort of establish yourself in.
And for this being your debut novel, how did the writing of this compare to the nonfiction that you've written before?
The nonfiction was straightforward in that you don't have to imagine your story. If you're writing a fiction, obviously you've got to take a lot of time to allow the characters to really come through, to let their voices come through, and to almost work with them as if they are actors on a stage and you're directing them. And they're saying, okay, we're here. What do you want us to do? Where do you want us to go? Where do you want to put us? And a bit like a director, you've got to sort of block their moves and direct them around the scene. So, that's the difficulty, I think, with fiction writing. If you're writing journalistic factual pieces, your other difficulty then is the research side of it. But that can be a tremendous amount of fun. And it's made so much easier in these days of the internet. Research is much, much easier than it used to be in pre-internet days.
Yes. And the fact that your book is set in history, did you have to do a certain amount of research for that as well?
For The Reunion, I was lucky in that the basis of it is coming from my wife's family's experience. She is of an Anglo-German family. Her father was a German POW who settled in Cornwall. These were fascinating stories to me. My wife, when she was a 10-year-old, was traveling in a Morris Minor van all the way from Cornwall, the west of Cornwall, right through to Bavaria, which is hundreds and hundreds of miles, and took days to get there. And so that was the basis of the beginning of the story of The Reunion. The second part of the story, of course, was set in East Berlin and East Germany. And, of course, I knew nothing about that side of things at all. So that's where the research came in. I was able to sort of find a tremendous amount of stories involving people on the eastern side of the border, which, of course, my wife's family had no connection with whatsoever.
Yes. So is part of it the story of your wife's family then?
That's the basis. That's the beginning of it. Just purely those early reunions. Absolutely. Whereas in the book, Hugo is the central character, finds himself being haunted by memories of his past. That was certainly not the case with my father-in-law. You know, I have no idea of my father-in-law being a former POW. I don't know how he was affected at all. I mean, you know, there's no sort of knowledge of that. So again, that is absolute creation. But when Hugo gets to the continent, he's being haunted by these ghosts of the past, of his wartime experiences.
Yeah. So other than that, what can you tell us about Hugo? What's he like as a person?
Hugo is a brilliant businessman. He's quite an incredible character, actually, because when he's brought to England as a POW in late 1944, after he's been captured, he can't speak any English. He's just a boy soldier. He's still a teenager. He's brought to Cornwall. He is given work on a farm, and he works really hard, and he begins to learn English, and he has a love of playing chess, and he's befriended by a Cornish farmer's son, who says, "Oh, Hugo, you know, this is, we can go and play chess with the locals, and I'll introduce you to local people," and so on. And through the game of chess, which Hugo has learned as a boy in Germany, he wins friends and influences people. And he begins to sort of build up a network, and he begins to build on his knowledge of the English language. He's also very fortunate in that he meets a land army girl called Renee. And Renee plays a big part in helping him to understand the language and to settle down and to become part of the community. And although he pays a return visit to his homeland in 1947 when he's released, what he finds is that Germany is in such a mess. People are starving. People are homeless. But it's not a country to return to at all. So he comes back to Cornwall. And this is when his entrepreneurial abilities kick into gear. And he begins to... He marries Renee, this land army girl. And they get they're given a position on a farm as a farm laborer, and she gets a position as a nanny. And in their cottage, they've got enough garden there to grow flowers, and they start growing flowers and sending them on the train to London and making some money for themselves. And so that's his entrepreneurial spirit really sort of kicking into gear. And they do tremendously well, and so well that he's able to buy his own farm. And by the time we begin the story of the reunion in 1963, he's a successful flower grower. And he's got enough money now to be able to have staff to look after the farm while he and his young family go back to Bavaria and see if they can establish this family reunion. His belief being that if he can introduce his young children, which is Hannah, who's 10, and her little brother, Marco, is only a baby at this point. But if he can introduce them to their cousins in Bavaria, and if people get to know one another, new generations get to know one another, there will be no more wars. The idea being that wars tend to be between strangers when people don't know one another. But when generations are brought up to know one another, then, you know, the chances of a war between them are going to be far less likely. It's a sort of first European Union, really, in a way.
Yes.
As far as a family are concerned.
And I suppose as the children going to this reunion will have no preconceived ideas about anything to do with the war and just will be probably happy to meet family.
Well, actually, they do, because Hannah is a very bright young girl who is destined to go to the grammar school, and she's very bright. And she's actually been watching the television, and she's been, you know, listening to her lessons and so on at school, and she's taking it all in. And she does know something about the war, you know, and she looks at her dad and she says, "Dad, you know, you've got a big nose. And now, surely Hitler, you know, he wanted to kill everybody who had big noses, but you've got a big nose, and, you know, would he have killed you?" And you know, Rene and Hugo turn and say, where do you learn this? And she said, "Well, you know, that time I was ill and I was at home and I had the school's broadcast on television, and it was a program I was watching about how he killed all these people. And they had big noses like you, you know." So she does know something. I mean, they just soak it up like sponges, as we all do. You know, in that first 10 years of life, you know, you're sort of soaking in whatever you can find in books and on television and in the classroom and so on. And this is exactly what she did. She's a very bright young girl. So she does have a knowledge of the Second World War. And she knows also, too, that her dad has had a difficult time in Cornwall, you know, that although he has been accepted, there are instances, and she finds this at school, you know, where children call her names because her dad's a German and so on. So she, you know, as a child, she feels she has to have an understanding of what's gone before her.
Yes. Well, if people want to see how this reunion turns out, then they need to get a copy of the book. It's called The Reunion. It's by Jeff Pridmore, who we've been chatting to. Jeff, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Melissa Oliver, whose debut novel, The Rebel Heiress and the Knight, has recently been awarded the Romantic Novelists Association prestigious Joan Hessian Award. They praise the novel's very real characters and enjoyed how the history was beautifully woven into the story. It's a medieval romance set against a backdrop of real historical events. Welcome to the book show, Melissa.
Thank you very much for having me, Hannah.
It's a pleasure, and congratulations. How exciting.
Oh, I'm really over the moon about it. It's quite a shock, actually, because I was one of 21 other contenders for this amazing award, and we all sort of came to the award via Zoom, obviously, in during these times. So I was just sat there, not really expecting very much, but just enjoying, you know, what was about to happen. And then at the very end of the proceedings, the lovely Katie Ford opened the envelope. And when she said my name, I was absolutely stunned. I just couldn't believe it. You know, I actually had to check. Did she just say me? So it was actually really, really a thrill, really. I'm over the moon about it.
Fantastic. You were accepted for publication after passing through the RNA's new writers scheme, weren't you? Tell us about that.
Yes, exactly. Well, the RNA also run a conference in the summer. So last summer in 2019, we all attended, and it's a really great way to network, meet prospective agents and publishers. And there's lots of great talks from established authors. So for a novice like me, and you know, at that time obviously I wasn't published, it was a great opportunity to attend these. It was like being back at university or something. But we also had a chance to do a one-to-one pitching session. So I actually, and before that you have to send a chapter of your work, and so I actually pitched this to the person who ended up becoming my, not only my publisher, but she actually ended up being my editor from that publisher as well, from Mills and Boone, from Harlequin Mills and Boone. So that was a great opportunity. But the book had already, it was going through the RNA new writer scheme. So you send in your work and you get a critique back, basically. So both of those things were kind of simultaneously happening at the same time. So I didn't get actually an offer of a book until at the end of last year.
Wow.
It all sort of happened very, very sort of quickly in a way. It
was, yeah.
It's taken me so long to get here, you know, lots and lots of rejections like many writers. And then for it to suddenly happen in such a short space of time is quite amazing, actually.
So it's been a pretty good year for you then.
It has overall. Obviously being, you know, sharing this whole sort of strange time with everybody else, though it hasn't been, obviously, this year's been quite a strange year on top of that. But professionally, it's been amazing, really. Yeah.
So tell me a bit about your background and where your interest in history comes from.
Well, I mean, I'm just a bit of a history buff. I didn't actually, you know, my training lies totally in the arts. But I've always wanted to become a writer. And so about 10, 15 years ago, I started to sort of attend lots of different classes and read up in so many different books and started reading and writing that way, learning my craft, you know, on the hoof, as it were. But I'm actually a trained designer. But, you know, for a long, long time, that's all I ever wanted to do was to become a writer. It's just I've always riddled with a bit of self-doubt whether I could do it or not, you know. And as I got going and sent my work to agents, although I was rejected, I always used to get quite good feedback. So I thought, well, this is something I definitely want to pursue. And as far as the historical aspect goes, I've always been interested in history ever since I was a small child, you know, being dragged around museums and different stately homes. I really used to love it. I used to sort of create almost imaginary kind of stories in my head about people. So I've always loved that, going to different castles, both in England and in Europe. I was very lucky to travel, you know, with my family, do on holidays, etc. So I really, really have always been fascinated by history, and that's never really left me.
Yeah.
So I've always sort of watched historical programs about, and all aspects of history as well. So that's always been with me. So it was a very natural progression later when I decided to actually go down this route to try and write a historical book, but more of a romantic book. So I realised that's where my strengths were, and that's what I really enjoyed doing as well.
And why medieval times particularly?
Well, they were really quite tumultuous times, you know. There's a lot of high stakes, so, you know. So the medieval era just offered that opportunity for a lot of intrigue, a lot of interest, when things weren't so straightforward, you know, and life was very precious because one minute you were at the top, the next you could be just thrown in, you know, a dungeon or you know, if you're on the battlefield, you're as a knight, for instance, or a foot soldier, you could lose your life. So it was a very perilous time. So I just thought the heightened times lent itself to lots of different types of stories being told, and I was quite fascinated by those and wanted to explore those further.
So tell us about some of the characters. Eleanor is one of the main characters, isn't she?
Yes. Now, yes, exactly. So the books of, you know, not the longest books, so they're 70,000. So the it concentrates on the two main characters, the male and female protagonists. Eleanor is quite an extraordinary character. She, you know, the idea of her came quite organically as I read more about real-life women from that era. So one of those women that came to mind when I was reading about her was Nicola de la Haye, who eventually ended up as a sergeant of Lincoln Castle. Another person was Eleanor of Aquitaine, and she had an extraordinary life, you know, and she outlived, I think, most of her children, certainly the two kings, so both King John and King Richard, she outlived both of them. So she's a really fascinating character as well, and I just thought it would be quite an interesting idea to sort of have somebody who had this past as well. So although she's fairly young in our terms, about 20, 21 when this story is written, she'd already had a previous marriage. As obviously girls of that sort of noble class would have married around the age of sort of 13, 14, 15 in that sort of period of time. And so she had pretty much quite an awful marriage in her first marriage. And it was just for me to come up with ideas of how she then coped with that, and her coping mechanism is quite extraordinary. So there's a definite nod to Robin Hood here as well.
Mm-hmm. And she's ordered to marry Hugh de Villiers. What can you tell us about him?
Yes, so he is definitely sort of very much a trusted knight of King John. So already the two of them stand on opposing sides, because the year that I've set this book is 1215, and this is the year that the Great Charter of Liberties is signed, or Magna Carta as it's also known. Mm. And so it's a really tumultuous year in English history, and so the country almost splits into half, really. So you've got the barons, the rebel barons on one side, and then you've got the king on the other. And it eventually does lead to the barons' conflict because he later reneges on this charter. So the two characters, although neither the signing nor the actual, the charter itself doesn't go into too much detail about that, but they're definitely there in the background. And the two characters, you've got the King's Knights, Hugh de Villiers, and you've got Eleanor of Calne, and they're kind of almost fighting this attraction but they are both on different sides. He doesn't really realise this until further down the line, really.
Right. So has it made you want to write more? Is it the kind of book that could have a sequel, or is it definitely a standalone?
It doesn't quite have a... I mean, there is a series now, because one of Hugh's friends, who's featured in this book, is actually the protagonist of the following book. So yes, although it's not a sequel as such, there is a series linked, and the linked series is called The Notorious Knights. So it features... Each book has a male protagonist who features in the previous book. So it's then... It sort of then becomes a sort of four-book series, basically.
Yeah.
Currently, I'm writing the third book, so the second book will be coming out in January of 2021 or at the beginning of February 2021. But yeah, that one's already done, actually, and dusted. And
oh,
I'm
wonderful.
Very, very pleased with that one, too.
And how did you find the second book? You know, when your first book does so well, it must be, pressure on to try and produce a good second book as well.
It really is. To be honest with you, the second book at first, I had to start obviously writing that once I got the publishing deal, but it wasn't once it became successful. So that I was, because of the timelines of how publishing works, the second book literally was written once we went down into lockdown, or just slightly before. And so I was sort of cocooned away doing my writing, basically. So none of the, this book hadn't been released yet. The first book hadn't been released, hadn't been published yet. So although it was really difficult to start again, almost to come up with ideas, do the research, etc., once I actually got stuck in, it was fairly straightforward. I do quite detailed synopses, so I kind of know what I'm doing and what I'm writing. I get into pitfalls now and again, and there's a lot of, especially for that sort of time, research. Sometimes you get to a point where you're just in a bit of a corner and can't work out whether or not, because there's nothing really written about that, so you have to sort of join the dots yourself. But other than that, it was fairly straightforward. The third book is definitely the one I'm writing currently. Obviously, it's been since the first one has been released, and subsequently winning this amazing award as well from the Romantic Novelist Association. So that's been a little bit harder. The pressure's definitely on. I can feel it on this one far more.
Oh, well, best of luck with it. In the meantime, if people want to get a copy of the award-winning The Rebel Heiress and the Knight, it's available on our website in the bookshop section. It's by Melissa Oliver, who we've been chatting to. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us, and well done.
Thank you so much, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Laura North, who writes psychological suspense novels that delve into the darker side of relationships and families. She has a lifelong passion for writing, reading, and all things books. Her love of psychological suspense has grown since childhood, and from her dark imagination of always wondering what's the worst thing that could happen in every situation. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel. It's called One Step Behind. Welcome to the Book Show, Lauren.
Oh, and thank you so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
Ah, it's lovely to have you. And I'm interested in learning a bit more about your lifelong kind of interest in psychological suspense and things like that. You were interested in that as a child, were you?
Well, I think in some respects I was, because I was always really interested in psychology, and I used to do little quizzes for my family, try and get to know them and find out little secrets about them and things. And I also have always had this quite dark imagination, always worried about what could happen in certain situations. I used to always be quite concerned about monsters under the bed and things like that. So I think it's been like a theme throughout my life to have this dark imagination and interested in the psychology of things.
Yeah.
Well.
So it was sort of obvious the type of books you were going to write then.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know if it was necessarily, because I did actually start my career in romance writing, and then have just seemed to have moved darker and darker with each book. I definitely have found my home now in psychological suspense, but I didn't start off thinking this is the kind of book I'm going to write. I think with romances, there's sort of a boy meets girl happy ending, so it's maybe quite a, I don't like to say simplistic because I don't want to belittle romances because I think they're amazing books. But I think when I first started, I saw it as perhaps a formula I could turn to start with. But then as I've progressed with my writing, I've sort of fallen into, I found my love really, and have worked from there really.
Mm. And when you're writing a psychological thriller, because the plots can sometimes be a little bit complicated and you've got to keep people wanting to turn the pages and maybe put a few twists in there, do you have to plan all of that before you start writing the book, or do you do it as you go along?
Well, I'm quite a planner. So I do try and plan the scenes and think about where I might put red herrings and where little twists might go. But then when I'm writing it, I think, oh, I'm now feeling a bit bored, which means the reader is definitely going to be bored. So I definitely need to add some more action here. And then as I edit, you sort of see it again, like where does it need more, more teasing, more reveals, more action, because you do want to lead the reader down multiple different paths of what they think might be going on, but you also need to be truthful and honest with them, and it's about making sure that you're still giving them enough clues so that when the twist and reveal happens at the end, they don't feel like they've been cheated in any way. So it's a real balancing act, I think, between wanting to mislead them but also making sure they've got some facts as well.
Yes. So do you find yourself when you're editing kind of reading back and then thinking, oh no, that there isn't enough clues, or maybe there's too many, maybe I've made it too obvious, and having to change things like that around?
Well, I think, yes, because I obviously know what's happened, I think it's really obvious. So then I often take things out to make it more cryptic, and then my editor will be like, nope, this needs to be clearer, this needs to go in. So it's really hard, I think, as the person who knows what's happening and who knows the characters inside out, it's really hard to sort of see them as the reader sees them when you've developed them all in your mind. But you can't give the reader everything you know about that character on chapter one or even throughout the whole book, because it would be quite a boring sort of explanation of them. So it's really hard, I think, sometimes for me to make sure that I've really portrayed everything I know about my character in the best way I can, which is another thing that I find my editors really great at helping me with, and making sure I've not overdone it on one aspect of her personality. And an example would be that in the book I'm editing at the moment, which is my next book, my character is quite anxious and quite a worrier, and my editor's come back and said, oh no, she's too much of a hand-wringer, I can see what you're trying to do, but you've gone too far down this road, so you need to rein it in a bit and have some lighter moments, which I think it's really interesting to have that perspective. I find it hard without, I think.
Yeah, it makes you realise the importance of having a good editor.
Oh yeah, there's definitely a big team involved. I think when you write your first draft, it's just you and it's just the book you want to write. And then the minute it's done, it's a massive team effort from the minute you've clicked send on an email. And it stays that way then throughout, because then you've obviously had the marketing and publicity people and the cover people. And it really becomes this huge team effort. So I'm always really grateful for everyone who's involved in the publication of my book.
Yeah. And how did you get published initially? Was it an easy road, or it can often be quite... It's going to be difficult.
Is there such a thing as an easy road for publication? I don't think. Well, I've been writing for a really long time. I think I did start quite young. So I think I started writing in my mid-20s and then had a couple of children and then sort of took it back up again when they were in sort of toddler age. So I had a little bit more time. So in my mind, I've been on and off writing for almost 15 years, I think. And I sort of was getting to a point where I was submitting to agents and I wasn't getting completely flat no rejections. I was getting, oh, I like it, but it's not quite for me. So I felt like I was getting somewhere, And then I went to some agent days and actually met with some agent and talked to them and worked out like where my pitch was going wrong, what kind of books I should be writing. And I really think I set about 1 year, and I sat down on New Year's Day 1 year and said, right, this is the year. I've got to pull myself together. I've got to write the best book I can write. And that's going to be the book that gets me an agent and a publishing deal. And I really gave myself a big talking to about being the best I can be. And that book was The Perfect Betrayal. So I did then, well, quite quickly after that, land an agent and a publishing deal within the same 6 months. So, but it was a long road to get there. I certainly went through many, many rejections and had to take a long, hard look at my writing and recognise that it's such a learning journey, and I wasn't anywhere close to being ready 10 years ago. So you've got to keep trying always, but you've also got to look at yourself and see what other people are seeing. Because I think when you're writing, you think it's the best thing ever, and you really have got to put yourself out there for criticism and learn from it.
Yeah, that's a great thing to be able to do. Not as I'm sure you've seen and realised, not everybody can do that. You know, when you've written something that you're
that's a real turning point. Yeah,
yeah, that you're so proud of and you've put everything into, and then people say, nah, you know, it's no good or whatever. It can be really difficult, and people think, oh, what's wrong with them? You know, that it's their other people's problems and that sort of thing.
Yes, exactly.
It's difficult.
That. And I certainly had that attitude for many, many years, and I felt it was them, not me. And I think it was only as I really progressed in my writing that I began to look back and realise that they were right. And when you realise that actually you should listen to people who know what they're talking about and believe them, then it does make a change. I would also say, though, don't listen to everybody else, though, because you might give your book out to people who are just friends and family, and they might give you some advice. They're not in the industry. They might not know what they're talking about. So don't listen to every piece of advice. I would only listen to those who definitely know what they're talking about.
Yes, that is good advice, Lauren. Thank you. So tell us a bit about what happens in your latest book, then, One Step Behind. The main character is Jenna.
Yes. So Jenna is a really busy woman. She has two children, Beth and Archie, who are both at school. She's married to Stuart, and she's also an A&E doctor, and she works very long shifts. She really loves her career. She's very focused. But she's also the victim of a very vicious stalker who, for the last year of her life, has been sort of progressively infringing on her life a lot more with horrible letters, horrible emails, gifts on her doorstep, following her when she's out with the kids. And it really pushes her to this sort of breaking point. And so that's where the novel opens up. We see her at this point in her life where it's all about to fall apart for her. She's barely keeping it together. But then very quickly, the path of her and her stalker cross when he's brought into A&E and she has to treat him for quite a serious injury. And suddenly the power becomes all hers, and she then has to make this decision on how many lines she's willing to cross to sort of take back control of her life, and how much truth she can find out from this person. So it's a stalker book, but it's also got this element of control and power as well from the main character.
Interesting. And what do you think Jenna is like as a person? Do we like her? Are we on her side?
I mean, I like her. I'm definitely on her side. I think many women would be able to identify with Jenna on quite a lot of levels, because I think a lot of women find themselves quite stretched. And, you know, we are in this place right now where we're supposed to be able to do it all and have it all. And she is trying to do all those things. And she has this passion to be a doctor, but she also has a family and a husband and a house to run. And it all falls to her. And she's juggling all these balls. So I think there's a lot of sympathy for her and how she's trying to sort of keep everything together, even with all this personal things going on in her personal life. But we do see her progress in the novel and change quite a lot when she sort of takes a hard look at herself. So I think there's a lot of sympathy for her. I mean, I wouldn't say she's quite a dive right in character. So she's very proactive and very and can be quite pushy, and so I think there are elements of a character which a reader might be like, oh, I'd never do that. But then I don't think you need to, as a reader, identify with every single aspect of a person. I think as long as the character is acting truthfully to who they are, then I think most readers will go along with it.
Definitely. Well, if people want to get a copy of One Step Behind, it's available on our website in the bookshop section. It's by Lauren North, who we've been chatting to. Lauren, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.